Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1300 hours GMT on Monday the 16th of September, these are our main stories. There's been a jump in global oil prices following drone attacks on refineries in Saudi Arabia. UN investigators have warned that ethnic Rohingyas who are still in Myanmar face the continuing threat of genocide. Japanese beer sales to South Korea have almost completely dried up as their trade dispute intensifies. Also in this podcast, tensions rise in Trinidad, where thousands of Venezuelans are seeking asylum.
We don't have housing in Trinidad. We don't have proper healthcare. So where are they getting housing and proper healthcare? You just bring them from one disaster into another disaster.
And we preview Tuesday's election in Israel. Saudi Arabia provides more than 12% of the world's oil. The drone attacks on two of its oil installations at the weekend have caused an international furore and a sharp rise in the price of crude oil. At one point, the cost of Brent crude rose by almost 20%, the biggest jump since the Gulf War back in 1990. Some market analysts are saying the disruption to oil supplies is unprecedented, as Dan Damon heard from our business correspondent, Dominic O'Connell.
It's a bigger disruption to supply than Gulf War I or the disruption that came in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution. Iran in those days was a big supplier to Western markets, not so much now, not at all now, in fact. And in terms of numbers of barrel, the size of the disruption, it is bigger. It's 5% of the world's total, half of all of Saudi Arabia's output. So it is larger. The question, though, is how long will it take the Saudis to restore production? Reuters has reported a well-placed Saudi official saying they should have about a third of the lost production up and running by the end of Monday, the end of today. But the question is, can they restore all of that lost production within weeks, or will it be months? And the bigger question, which is really in traders' minds, is what does it mean for the future of Saudi oil supplies? How vulnerable are they to similar kinds of attacks in the future? And indeed, the ratcheting up of tension in the whole region.
We'll come to that in a moment. But the distribution of oil production is different than in those instances you gave us. Fracking is now a thing, isn't it? Does that change the picture?
Yes. So one way of looking at it is what's happened to stock markets rather than the oil price. And in essence, not much has happened to stock markets overnight. The Hang Seng Index in Hong Kong was down 1%. The FTSE 100 has just opened in London unchanged. Now, in the past, when you had a big disruption to oil supplies, the way it worked was that US consumers had to pay more for stuff because oil prices went up, and that could, in the worst of occasions, lead to a recession in the world economy because US consumers stopped spending and that drove the world economy into recession. But these days, about three-quarters of all Middle Eastern oil goes not to the US but to Asia because the domestic oil industry in the US has undergone a complete change. Shale gas and shale oil now means that America is actually a net exporter of oil. So it's pretty self-sufficient oil if it wants to be. So the effect on the US consumer will not be as marked, even if it is a significant and long-lasting dislocation, will not be as marked as it has been in the past. It's also worth noting that we have had a big jump in oil prices when oil trading started last night, when it reopened after the Friday close. It went from $60 up to $71. It's now come back down to about $67, 10% up, not 20% up. So it's clear that actually traders are starting to take a slightly more measured view of what this might mean.
It does affect China seriously, doesn't it? And if you take into account the trade war with the US and you look at the, as you said, the rising tension in the Middle East, traders must be alarmed.
Well, I think equity traders have for a while been looking for a reason to sell. There's just been an expression that the markets are high but hollow because we're still, even though the markets have come off a bit in the last 6 months, we're still at the end of, still in the middle of, we don't know if it's the end or the middle or where it is, of what's been the longest bull market, i.e. upward market, in the history of world stock markets. It's been running for more than 10 years now. So traders are naturally suspicious that actually there might be a reason to sell. And this is a reminder of these geopolitical tensions in the Middle East is another reason to sell. US-China trade war, Brexit, all that kind of stuff. So one thing you will see as a result of this on Wednesday is that the Federal Reserve, the US's central bank, has to announce its latest interest rate decision. And it's widely been expected that they will cut interest rates again. I think that is almost a nailed-on certainty now. They now have a very good reason for saying we need to stimulate the US economy even more because of the fears over trade, now oil as well as everything else. So more cuts in interest rates to come in the US in an attempt to stimulate the US market and stimulate the stock market, which Donald Trump is very keen on.
Dominic O'Connell speaking to Dan Damon. United Nations investigators say that more than 500,000 Rohingya still living in Myanmar are at risk of genocide. In a report by the UN Human Rights Council, the investigators say that a return of the 1 million Rohingya refugees living in neighbouring Bangladesh would be impossible in these conditions. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
600,000 Rohingya Muslims remain in Myanmar. This latest UN report says they are subjected to such repression, including torture, sexual violence, restriction of movement and denial of humanitarian aid, that they live under the threat of genocide. The UN investigators say Myanmar's government has done nothing to prevent this persecution and should be brought before the International Court of Justice for failing to honour its obligations under the Convention Against Genocide. In its first report last year, the UN named leading figures in Myanmar's military in connection with crimes against humanity. But 1 year later, the military continues its operations against the Rohingya and is even, this report claims, using its own business links and arms deals with foreign companies to support brutal operations against ethnic groups.
Imogen Folks. Beer drinkers in South Korea are waving goodbye to some of their favourite drinks because of a trade spat with Japan. Imports of popular brands like Asahi and Sapporo have almost ground to a halt. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow told me more.
Well, it's a fallout from a trade war between South Korea and Japan, which goes back to last year when a South Korean court ordered Japanese companies to compensate workers who'd been forced to work for these firms during the Second World War. The Japanese firms refused, and there's been a tit-for-tat series of measures by each government ever since then. The South Koreans have also decided to boycott lots of goods from Japan, and beer is one of them, as you've indicated there, virtually fallen to zero. And we're talking about brands of beer which were the favourite foreign imports for South Korean drinkers before this boycott got underway in July.
And it's not just beer being affected, is it?
It's all kinds of things, all kinds of retail items, clothes, cosmetics, cars. It's even spilling over into diplomatic relations between the two countries. So you have, for example, a brewing argument about flags to be used in next year's Tokyo Olympics. Even last week, when the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan talked about releasing contaminated water into the sea, the biggest complainant was South Korea. And many people suggesting that this trade war is kind of affecting and infecting all kinds of relations between two countries at a time when it ought not to be.
You say it's a trade war. Is it something more than that?
Well, essentially, the roots of all of this is the Second World War and Japanese aggression on the Korean Peninsula. Japan believes that when the two countries re-established, South Korea and Japan established diplomatic relations in 1965, the whole of the past was done and dusted, nothing more to talk about. South Koreans disagree. They think Japan hasn't properly apologised. And essentially, that's the root of all these problems, even though they should be great friends, both democracies, both allies of America.
Michael Bristow. 4 million Venezuelans have fled the political and economic crisis in the country. 40,000 of them are now in the Caribbean islands of Trinidad and Tobago, many paying people traffickers to make the dangerous journey by boat. Trinidad has taken in more Venezuelans per capita than any other country. But life isn't simple for those who arrive, and some locals have made it clear they're not welcome. Ashley John Baptiste reports.
These Venezuelans are being sold false dreams and promises.
Hundreds of locals fill the streets of Trinidad. The chants are calls for an election. They're angry at their government because they say the vast number of Venezuelans who have fled to this small island are not coming to claim asylum, but for jobs.
We don't have housing in Trinidad. We don't have proper health care. So where are they getting houses and proper health care? You just bring them from one disaster into another disaster.
An election is due next year, and the message from the government is clear.
Venezuelan problem is for Venezuelans.
Prime Minister Keith Rowley.
This little island cannot be the solution to millions or hundreds of thousands of migrants leaving Venezuela.
Sitting with his family in a small house, Manuel Romero shows me a video on his phone. It's the annual opening of the courts in Caracas, where he was a judge. After seeing colleagues jailed for not following government rulings, he fled with his wife and kids last summer. Now he is in limbo. Since arriving, he's worked as a fisherman, a carpenter, and now a security guard in a shopping centre.
It sounds like to some level you have been stripped of your identity. How do you feel about the new identity that you have here in Trinidad?
Un temor indescriptible.
I was afraid to leave everything behind because as a man there are expectations of what you need to do. It's like leaping into the unknown. But I'm not the last person who will have to make this leap. But being an immigrant in Trinidad is very hard. People come seeking asylum and the government here doesn't respect that.
Trinidad and Tobago has no laws protecting asylum seekers. So until recently, Venezuelans had no rights to live or work here. In some attempts to manage the crisis, the government created a registration period in June. For 2 weeks, any Venezuelan could register for the right to live and work. But the centres allocated for processing were chaotic and confusing.
All I see is a mass of desperate humanity needing help.
I'm assuming that many here will not get registered. I mean, it's quite obvious if today's the last day.
Yes.
What will happen to those people?
The authorities have not let us know what's going to happen, but they are desperate to get into this process.
As we approached the deadline, police blocked off the line. The government declared that all unregistered Venezuelans would return to illegal status. As it stands, the government refuses to reopen registration. Those who weren't registered are in limbo, but so are those families who made it through. Permits are limited to just 1 year's work allowance, and Venezuelan children cannot attend school.
You need help.
Back at home, Manuel is helping his daughter learn English. He did manage to register in time, but he's concerned for the future of his 17 and 5-year-old kids. I feel boxed in, he tells me. He's worried that after the allotted year, his family will simply be deported back to Venezuela. For now, the permits means families like Manuel's can play safely in the park without fear of deportation. But as the crisis continues in Venezuela, many continue to flee their country. Inevitably, this is only a temporary solution to a problem that isn't going away.
Ashley John Baptiste. Coming up, the world's first climate telethon in Denmark raises enough money to plant almost a million trees. Israel is holding another general election on Tuesday after the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu failed to form a stable coalition after a vote in April. And as he fights for his political life, Mr. Netanyahu has pledged that he'll annex immediately about 20% of the occupied West Bank in the strategic Jordan Valley if he's re-elected. He hinted the plan had the support of Donald Trump, despite any such move being illegal under international law. Here's our Middle East editor, Jeremy Byrne.
Everything is very close in this troubled land. It's small. Driving around and across land that's been fought over doesn't take long. Enemies, resentment, hopes and disappointment are never far away. We're heading through the Jordan Valley. It runs between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, mostly sandy and rocky desert. The domes of the Monastery of the Temptation, built into the cliffs, stare down on Jericho, the Palestinian city that claims to be the oldest in the world. The southern end of the valley, where I am, has been occupied by Israel since 1967, a big part of the land it captured in that year's Middle East War. Usually, the valley is a sleepy place, but Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has pushed it into his country's general election, which is coming up this Tuesday. He declared that if he was returned as Prime Minister, he would annex the Jordan Valley and Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. The suggestion has been condemned by many of Israel's friends, including Britain, on the grounds that it would be yet another nail in the coffin containing hopes for peace. Israel would have absorbed land Palestinians want for a state. Mr. Netanyahu said similar things before. Perhaps he won't keep his promise if he wins. Perhaps he will. He's offering Israeli right-wingers a tasty electoral inducement to vote for him. He needs the votes. The election will be close. More than anything else, it's a referendum on Benjamin Netanyahu, who's overtaken Israel's founding father, David Ben-Gurion, as its longest-serving prime minister. I've come to Jerusalem, and in the last hours before the election, there are rallies going on. I'm in one of the ultra-religious parts of the city. There are thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews here. They're here to support coalition of religious parties. But for Prime Minister, the vast majority of them will be supporting Benjamin Netanyahu. They are a vital part of his governing alliance, and without them, he can't form a government. Israel is a strong country. Its achievements are remarkable. But it also has a streak of insecurity, understandable given the history of the Jews and of the Israeli state. Benjamin Netanyahu plays on those fears. His campaign has majored on Israel's enemies in Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. His message, repeated time after time, is that the Middle East is a tough neighborhood and he's the only politician who can keep Israelis safe. His main rival is a center-left coalition called Blue and White, led by a retired general, Benny Gantz, and Yair Lapid, a TV personality turned politician. General Gantz says he can restore honor to the premiership. Mr. Netanyahu is facing serious corruption charges, which he denies. His opponents say he's divided and cheapened Israel. It might come down to turnout. Israelis get election days off, and it's perfect beach weather.
Jeremy Bowen. A number of British celebrities, including the former England football captain Gary Lineker, have agreed not to highlight the abusive messages they get on social media. It follows research which suggests that drawing attention to offensive comments is counterproductive, as Tom Singleton reports.
The hate-filled comments directed towards high-profile people online frequently make the news, often accompanied by messages of sympathy or outrage from other figures in public life. But a study carried out by the Centre for Countering Digital Hate suggests spreading the offensive comments to a wider audience is exactly what so-called trolls want. Better, they say, to block or mute the abusers, contact the police or, if needs be, take a break from social media. Gary Lineker, who has 7.5 million Twitter followers, says the lesson he's learned is don't rise to the bait, block the trolls and take some time out.
Tom Singleton. The UK's former chief scientist, Sir David King, says the fast pace of climate change is scary. In an interview for the BBC, he said extreme weather events and the speed at which Arctic ice is melting suggest that measures to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases need to be implemented earlier than currently planned. But his use of emotive language hasn't gone unchallenged. It's the latest chapter in the long debate over how to communicate climate science to the public. Here's our environment analyst, Roger Harabin.
Professor King told us the climate was changing faster than he expected. He said the extent of ice melt was scary, and he said weather extremes like the extraordinary heat wave in France this summer or the slow movement of Hurricane Dorian hadn't been well predicted.
We're seeing extreme weather events just rolling out year after year with massive loss of life. Is this a scary scenario? Of course it is. And how should we react as human beings to this scenario? We have to all pull together and understand the challenges and act to stop it.
Some scientists we contacted said events were generally within the range of predictions from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report in 2014, although some were at the top end of forecasts. Other scientists said they too had been scared by recent warming. But Petteri Tallas, the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, told us young people were becoming stressed and depressed by alarming language. He said climate science itself was convincing and dramatic enough. The young climate campaigner Greta Thunberg has argued that the climate won't be protected unless people do feel fear.
Roger Harabin. Well, over the weekend, Denmark held what's thought to have been the world's first telethon event to focus on climate issues. Organisers raised enough money to plant nearly a million trees around the country. One of those behind this project is Lars Heiselberg Vang Jensen, the chairman of the Growing Trees Network Foundation.
It's so amazing. We are so grateful and so happy and, yeah, so much looking forward what to come. Now it's started.
Yeah. And when will it start then? So you've raised enough money to plant nearly a million trees. I guess time is of the essence, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it really started some time ago. And I like to express sincere gratitude to the Danish Society for Nature Conservation and the TV2 channel who set up this major event that was calling for the Danes to participate. And now, when the Danes really went for it, in this autumn we will start to plant a lot of forest around the country, and that will happen on municipality land, church land, and land from the Danish Nature Agency owned by the government. And these lands were also many places supported by water plants, because most of the forest will be planted on top of important groundwater resources to help maintain clean drinking water. Same time, helping the climate and helping towards also crisis with the biodiversity.
And it's an incredible figure you reached, 2.4 million euros. Why is this an issue that has really struck a chord with the Danes, do you think?
The awareness with the climate challenges keeps coming in the news broadcast from people like you and all over the world. And it's really calling on that we should do massive actions. And when TV goes out with an exponential initiative like this, reaching out, asking that everyone can make a difference, whether you are in a company, whether you're private or funding, whether you are an adult or a child, it's really reaching out that everyone can make a difference. And of course, that taps into people's heart and their love and concern for nature and the climate.
And of course, we've had Greta Thunberg shaming politicians around the world, drawing attention to this issue. The Danish government, do you think they're doing enough? Or have you done this as a direct result of there being a lack of action in Denmark on this issue?
I think there's been a lack of actions in Denmark and, yeah, allow me to say, all around the world. And, yeah, the Danish government are saying now that they want to do a lot more. But still, I think we should reach out to ask the Danish government and all governments and, yeah, private people, companies, fundings all around the world, that we have to come together and do something to solve this climate challenge together. That's really what the challenges are calling for.
Lars, I understand you begin every morning with a swim in your local river, which is clearly a sign the natural environment is important to you. Have you had your swim yet this morning?
Oh, yes. I had a lovely swim going out with my wife and our dog Puppet and connected to the nature and had a quiet moment. It was wonderful.
Lars Heiselberg Vang Jensen speaking to the BBC's Claire McDonnell. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. We're calling on your help to make your listening experience the best imaginable. All you need to do is take a short survey. Visit acast.com/survey. That's acast.com/survey. Your opinion matters.